0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. Cullum O'Mungine here. You can get us on 0818 715 815. Text us on 51551. Email joe@rte.ie, or you can WhatsApp us on 0871843709. Angelina, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Cullum. Thank you for allowing me on the radio today.
Tell us about Edward.
Well, I'm a single parent and I live alone with my autistic son, and Edward is 30 years of age. And my concerns are, it's just the lack of funding and supports made available, you know, from the HSC and Department of Health. And I'm a parent who's in fear of my son's future and what could happen to him in my passing.
You contacted us and you said that you fear dying on a daily basis.
Yes. I worry. Edward is autistic.
What age is he?
He's 30. He would say, "Mum, will you always be there for me?" Like, that's a promise I can't keep, you know, and he wants to know what his future is, you know, and it's sort of trying to get supports for my son. It's very hard. And, you know, I can get, frustrated with the lack of responses from the HSE. You know, I feel alone and isolated, and I struggle to access supports for my son, you know, and I do feel unheard by the system.
And what do you say when Edward does ask you, "Mammy, will you always be there for me?" What answer do you give him?
I joke. I say to Edward, "Mammy loves you." I try to, I can't make a promise I don't keep, but I say to him, "Edward, Mammy will always keep you safe." And that's why I'm trying hard, to get Edward the supports and sort of build a foundation, a pathway that he knows that when I pass, and I will pass, that he's got a home from home. And that's what I'm battling with over the years to try to achieve.
What are his needs in terms of your need for him to have a home for home after your time, which, I mean, you're not an old woman at the moment. You're of a working age, but clearly your concerns are coming in this early because of the level of need that Edward has. So what are his needs?
Well, he would need supported living. Edward is very concerned. He's anxious. He can have high stress levels, you know, and it does affect both our health badly, because I'm trying to cope with his stress and anxiety. He is alone with me, and he, you know, his thing is he wants friends, you know, to be in. I know what he needs. He needs to be he needs to be able to have a life, you know, and learn to develop life skills and learn to cope in my passing. And what he needs is a slow introduction or a pathway, which is what I'm seeking for Edward. That
just explain that explain that to somebody who mightn't understand. If you were to die suddenly, and if Edward were to be put into a situation that was unfamiliar to him suddenly, what impact would that have on Edward?
Well, it would be detrimental, because if I was to pass in the morning, my fear is, what I've been told is that Edward could end up on an A&E in a hospital and he could be put anywhere. Now, my son is autistic and he needs to know, and there's a fear of the unknown. And what he would need is a slow release. What I would like for him is to have residential between home and between supported living, to introduce him gradually, which is crucial. I mean, it would be devastating to my son in my passing to be pulled somewhere that he didn't know. He knows his community, his day service is very kind, and this is what he needs. It's trying to get that pathway. As I said to you, like, you know, I'm so afraid to die without a resolution. And that's the way I feel at the moment, you know, like my dreams would be for better communication, you know, a commitment for planning for resolutions rather than being told no funding, end of story, you know, to create a pathway for the voice of parents and people left on trying to get on waiting lists, you know, funding for disability supports that's meaningful and has an impact in addressing the volume of needs on demand. And it's just not happening.
Well, we have seen information to the extent that it says that in 2022, there are 500 applicants for residential care in your area. In 2022, there was €600,000 received to fund four planned residential placements. But the people who are availing of them, the priority people, are parents who are in their 90s, who are now caring for aging dependent offspring.
That's very, very true, Colm. You know, there's 500, there's 499, including my son. And, you know, it's horrific. And I'd love these people to come forward. You know, as I said to you again, I'm very alone and isolated. Those people are out there in my catchment area alone. And it's just very frustrating and saddening to see what's happening, you know, to these young, vulnerable adults. It really is. And even to the aging parents, it's sad. And, you know, a parent myself that is of younger years than those parents, I'm finding it increasingly, you know, difficult sometimes to deal with the demands that I know he needs and I can't offer to him.
Like physically, what demands are you talking about?
He needs reassurance. He needs physically, like, I can give you an example. I have sort of...
Take your time.
I could never go out. Edward is my life. I love Edward, but I can't. If I went outside the door, he's so attached to me, which is really a very hard thing. He can just get very upset and get very agitated and vent and that. I hurt my back. He's afraid I'm going to die. He always wants to be kept busy. Another fear that I try my best, like I work, I try my best what I can do, but it's always on to the next thing. He's an adorable big man, but he's very big and I'm very, very small and I do try my best, but I can't fulfill what he looks and what he needs. And he would say to me, "Mammy, I want a house with friends. I'm lonely. And how do I deal with that?" You know, I'm trying my best to get him what he needs. And I'd love to see him develop life skills, coping skills in my passing, you know, that he could have.
And what does he
develop? I just feel...
You say he likes to be kept busy, but what does that involve? What kind of... How does he like to be kept busy? What does he like to do?
He likes... boxing, keep fit like that. The day service is quite good. They fulfill those. Then I'd have to, when I come back in the evening, I'd have to do things with them, bring him for walks to keep him from getting too agitated or upset. He's terrified at the moment of loss. Loss is a big thing at the moment for him. It's really, really, it's repeated every day. Some days, if he's very anxious, he could come in to me at the night, you know, for me to reassure him. He's just constantly looking for answers, you know, and
And you say your back is at you at the moment. I mean, how are you managing to keep the exercise levels up when your back is at you?
I was trying to support him because he was limping, and I was trying to support him to get him to A&E, and I hurt my back. So now I have to get medication. He's a big guy and it's hard for me to kind of hold him, you know, which is what I had to do. So that's why I'm actually on the radio to you today.
Yeah, which I'm sure it is not the way you wanted to approach it. But when you went through official channels and you laid out your need for residential care after your time has passed and maybe a plan to transition him to that residential care, what kind of answers have you got from the HSE?
No funding. No funding. That's all. Closed door. No funding. I've been battling and battling this for years. And as I said to you before, like meaningful responses, better communication, just give me a pathway for my son that I can reassure him that everything is going to be okay. And mommy keeps her promise.
They said in a statement
I'm terrified.
The HSE said to us, the HSE said to us in a statement that we looked for earlier, with regard to residential places, it says the demand for full-time residential placements is extremely high. The scale and need and necessary funding to meet current and future needs is set up in the Disability Capacity Review. And that goes on to say that in other information we've seen that demands up until 2032, so for the next decade, is going to need another 350 million.
Yes, well, I know there's a lot of money there. I just can't understand. There's four, as far as I can make out, that there's four residential placements are released a year. So I don't know where my son is on the list, but I know that when I calculated, my son would be 125 if he was to get a placement. He'd be well dead and buried. And he's been on that list since 2010.
And you clearly worry that you're going to be one of those parents, if you survive to your 90s, in your 90s, still looking for an answer, waiting for an allocation, are you?
Yes, I'm terrified. As I said to you before, Colin, I'm afraid to die. Edward is on my mind, you know, and he relates to me. It's just like, you know, I'm so isolated. And because of that, there's no social life for me because I can't, because I'm so busy dealing with my son, you know, to try and get him right. And I just feel at this stage that it's Edward I have to keep safe. And I just don't seem to be getting, as I said to you, I'm just frustrated. I feel so alone and isolated. I really, really do. And I know.
And how do you manage it? You said you work there. Mm-hmm. So you work when he's in his day service, do you?
I'm one of the fortunate ones, yes. And I'm there to get him when he comes off his bus.
And that's it then.
So I have two jobs. Yes, I work with special needs. And when I come home, it's 24/7. And I do it with the heart and half. But I know, Colm, I am not going to be able to do that in years to come. I'm not going to be able to meet what I'm meeting now. And that worries me something terrible.
And is there a network, a family nearby? Does anyone call into you? What is your social life?
Well, how can I say it? I'd rather not talk about it, to be perfectly honest with you, because I don't know how I can relate that to you. My social life is my son. That's basically it. It's my son, because I have to make sure he's first place, you know. And like at this stage, like, you know, he'd be, as I said to you, Edward gets terrified if I am away from him, he's just as terrified. COVID has played a big, big impact on him.
In what
he
way?
Is so terrified that I'm dying. He feels if I have a cold or a sniffle. He went out this morning, literally devastated, phoning me, has a little phone. Are you okay, Mum? You're not going to die. And I probably, he thinks I'm going to die all the time. Anytime I try to hide it, there was one time my health wasn't too good. I had to get a growth removed, and I couldn't talk for 6 weeks, and it was horrible. It was extended because I had to try and speak to try and console him. So it's things like that. He can't deal with me. I just think he's so attached to me that it's going to be very, if he doesn't get these supports put in place, I just think it's going to be devastating for my son. And I think to go to my grave thinking that I failed my son and the system has failed him goes really, really hard on me. Really, really hard on me.
And Angelina's not alone, is she?
Hello, yes. No, she's not. She's not alone. She's not alone. I, you know, it's just, there are no services for people with disabilities. Let's just be, there's no services. Long-term services or long-term care is not, it's nil, as far as I can see.
And tell us about your situation. Tell us about Matthew.
Matthew is my son. He's 22 years of age. He lives at home with us. But like Angelina, I'm in my 60s, my late 60s, and I know, and my husband as well is with me, we know we won't be able to look after Matthew's needs when we go. And he has autism as well, and he needs to be integrated into a service. I need to know, and he needs to have, you know, be coming and going and be gradually integrated into a service and know that he's there and that he has a house of his own and he's living with people of his own age. I have three other sons, and they've all gone away and come back naturally, and Matthew looks at them, and he's non-verbal, but I know he understands, and I'm sure he's wondering, when is my turn to go? He has respite, and he goes, and he loves going. But that's what he needs. And he's, you know, he looks at it. He's an older brother who's 25, who's really minded him all his life. He's 25. And he's like, you know, he looks into Michael's room sometime, and he sees what he's doing. And I kind of look at him, and he goes, will it ever be my turn? I just feel that's what he feels, and I know him very well.
And
but
how
yeah,
do you... He wonders when it'll be his turn to have some kind of an independent
house,
life
like,
of its own, is it?
Yeah. Because he's quite independent, even though he's non-verbal. Like, I think sometimes people think of non-verbal, well, they don't, obviously, but that he understands everything. And he looks, you know, he looks with Michael and he plays with them and he integrates. And my other two sons, one is in America and the other is in Brussels. And they come home and he smiles and looks at them and she's glad to see them. And, you know, we can't, like, it's just very difficult. And knowing that, like, there's no plan. Matthew's on the database since he was 4 years of age. Everybody knows his needs. They know what he wants and what he will need. But yet, there's no funding. So it's kind of like, they know he's there. But, I mean, I don't know if they expect that he's going to, because he's 18, he's going to just start talking and doing all the things he didn't do as a child. But, I don't know. It's just, I mean, I have a plan. I would love for all parents that have children like that to bring them up to the door someday when they're in a session with something very important and just let them get out, let them walk around and see. They would go insane anyway because they wouldn't be able to understand the sensory needs of, you know, the people that are talking, the noises and everything, because they would be out of their comfort zone. They'd be out of their, you know, their routine. But I would love to do it. Let them see for once, like, what it's like. And what their needs are, and what we do every day to keep them and support them.
But most parents who are full-time carers and in that situation probably don't have the time or the wherewithal to join that protest if it ever happened, do they?
Well, maybe we might manage it if we got a bit of support. You'd never know, because I think we're getting so frustrated at this stage and so frustrated by being told, no, there are no services, there are no long-term care plans, there are no houses, there is no... You know, and it's not even... I'm going to go... Veer away from even long-term care. My son has dental problems the last 2 years. He's on a waiting list in Galway Regional Hospital. He needs an anaesthetic to have a wisdom tooth out, and it's not happened. And I'm told, one day I'm told it'll be next week, and then I'm told, well, it depends on trauma coming in. Matthew will have to either be dying or have cancer before they can do his tooth.
And when...
No, I'm sorry, that's what I've been told, and that's our services in 2022. And, like, you know, I can't understand it.
And when the HSE says, and again going back to their statement, that it works with service users and their families to enable each individual with a disability to achieve his or her full potential and maximise independence, including living as independently as possible, what do you say to that?
Bunkum. Having said that, I will be positive. He has a very good daycare service, and I must compliment all the people that work with him in his daycare services. They're absolutely brilliant. But he's there from 9 to 4. After that, it's 4 o'clock, and weekends, bank holiday weekends, everything else, we're with them. And it's got to a stage where he needs long-term care.
And what do you have to do with Matthew? What are his requirements when he's at home in terms of, you heard Angelina saying that Edward needs to be, he kept busy, he needs exercise to stop him getting agitated, and he needs to be in close proximity with her. Does Matthew have similar needs?
Matthew has needs. Matthew loves walking. Matthew would walk forever. In woods, out in woods, anywhere there's no people or no noises, and he absolutely loves it. But my husband, in fairness, is very good. He brings them walking a lot. He brings them, takes off. He loves going for spins in the car. Wilson could be sitting down for some nights and he would be up two and three times. He looks in and he looks in. Yeah, we'll bring the keys that he wants to go for a spin. He loves the car and he loves going in. He loves going out, actually. He loves being independent if he was kind of able like that.
He's up during the night, is he?
No, it's the evening time. He's up at night as well. He doesn't sleep that great, but he's got a bit better than he was when he was younger. But there are nights that he can be, you know, he finds it hard to settle to sleep.
Right. And what about, you know, when he was younger and he was up during the night, would he have been fairly active during the night? Was he looking to take exercise at that stage as well, was he?
Well, he wasn't. He was just, he wouldn't stay in bed. He'd be up, down, back and over, as you do with autism anyway, because, you know, you need to kind of, I suppose it's a way of getting rid of the anxiety, to jump up and down or do what you have to do to get rid of the, you know, the anxiety in your mind and your body. That's the way they do it. I don't know if you read the book, Why I Jump. It's a very good one about somebody that has autism and they're on the trampoline and they're all the time on it. But he talks about how, why he jumps on the trampoline, because it releases anxiety and sensory issues and all that stuff.
Well, you heard Angelina saying there a moment ago, or a short while ago, that, you know, Edward had asked her, "Mammy, will you always be there for me?" How does Matthew communicate his needs to you? Or is, you know, you say you see him looking into rooms and you suspect he's wondering about what's in store for him. How does he communicate that, or how do you read that from
him? He does RPM as well, and we're plugged to RPM as well. It's a rapid prompt method which he uses with the board, and he types out or he touches the letters of what he needs and what he doesn't need. Now, I don't ask him about his emotions, I don't know, but I know sometimes the way he looks and the way he seems very lonely and very kind of isolated, I'd say. And as well, I could see what's coming with Matthew before, but I can see it half an hour before it comes, you know, that kind of way, because I know him so well. I told it to his dad, yeah, everybody does. If we can read, it's amazing, actually, the way he understands, and actually he knows and we know, but that's autism, you know.
Joan, you're in a similar situation as well.
Absolutely, listening to those people. I'm living in Kilkenny and my son is living with me. I'm a single parent and I went to hospital recently and I was in for 11 days and he had a meltdown, very, very worried and anxious, and he'd nobody to go to. Since COVID, the support services, we used to have somebody to talk to about his anger management, but there's nobody there. He actually said to me, "Mum, I don't know who to talk to," you know, and he was very upset because it was the unknown. He thought I was going to die, and his siblings live abroad, so...
Where was he when you were in hospital, Joan?
I had a friend to come and stay that he knows, and she worked from home, that was fine. But even at that, coming in and seeing me before I got into hospital, I was in so much pain. He couldn't cope with seeing me in pain, and it was just devastating, you know. And like that, I'm so worried about what will happen to him when I die. You know, I was talking to support services for the yearly review, and I was told the services have been taken away and you will not get assisted living. He said, and I said, what will happen to him if he dies in the morning? She said, oh, he'll have to go homeless. I mean, it's just dreadful.
So sorry, dreadful. If you mean what would happen if you died in the morning, is it?
Yeah, in the morning. Just say, like, there's only him in the house. But what she was saying, to get any place, you have to go homeless before you can get anything. I mean, that's how drastic it is. I mean, I couldn't, you know, put him out on the road just for that. But it's actually frustrating living with an adult as well that has all these needs. They get so frustrated. I mean, he gets so angry. You get doors are banged and, you know, things are broken because he's not getting the service and he's so frustrated. I mean, a lot of times says, I hate living here, you know, and he bangs out, goes for a walk. And then he'll say, I'm sorry, you know, but I know he's so frustrated, you know.
What kind of a day service does he have, if any, Joan?
It's been, okay, he has. Initially he had 5 days a week. That is now down to 2 days a week. And I've been told at the meeting that it will be cut down to 5 hours a week. I mean, they're just taking the services away. And he needs those supports, you know. I don't know what's going to happen.
And why?
You know,
what reason have you been given for the reduction of a service from 5 days down to 2 days down to 5 hours?
That, Yes, that's the funding from the HSE. It's been cut because he's had it. They're trying to gradually move these people on. I mean, you can't just move them on. They still need the support and services, you know.
Move them on to what?
Move on. Now, and the good thing is he's got a part-time job 3 days a week. But even at that, I don't know how long he's going to stay in the job, but he comes home sometimes frustrated because something happened. He can easily be frustrated. And then, as I say, he has the 2 days a week. And I've been told from August, it'll be just 5 hours. It's just ridiculous. And
Joan,
I've actually... Go on.
And Angelina, just stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungoyne here, 51551 for your text, joe@rte.ie for your emails and WhatsApp us, 087-184-3709. Joan, what are you looking for in terms of future planning for your son's needs?
Well, like that first lady, I would love for him to get a place in assisted living and to have a gradual, you know, phase of going in and so he gets used to it. And then if something happened to me, then he would have this other life and he'd be, you know, he'd be okay. I have a sister, she's in a place now from the John of God, and that's what happened. My parents thought they raised the money, and now she's in this house and it's being supported, you know, 7 days a week. And that's what I would like. And it was a gradual process. So when my parents passed away, she just lived there and it wasn't a big upset for her because she had these other people and she knew what it was like. So that's the same sort of thing I'd like for my son.
Is it more frustrating for you then to have seen your parents have a plan in place and you find yourself in a situation where there's not a similar plan in place?
They had to fight and fundraise for it for years. And I feel, oh my God, this is happening again, a full circle, where I'm trying to fight for a place. But it shouldn't be in this day and age. I mean, we hear all the ads for autism and everything. And I think people are under the belief that, you know, they're being looked after. But they're not. Maybe to get diagnosis is much better now. But not, you know, for these young adults, you know, moving on. It's not there. It's been taken away.
We heard from Angelina there at the start of the programme talking about her son Edward and, you know, looking for services for him and some reassurance that there'd be something residential in place.
I'd never have to worry about Connor about 10 years ago, that the HSE would look after him. He's in the system. That's what they told me. But now he's not. So it was a complete shock for me to hear that he couldn't avail of this assisted living.
Deborah, you're starting off on a very similar process.
Yes.
Based on what you've heard so far, does it give you much encouragement?
No, but I knew there was no, light at the end of the tunnel anyway. Everybody knows what's going on. Because everybody talks to the next special care mum that they know. Do you know what I mean?
So what situation are you in? Your daughter has Down syndrome.
My daughter, she has Down syndrome. She's 17. So it would be in her psyche to start, you know, thinking and looking and starting these processes. And as the lady said, it makes sense to kind of, you know, go out for the odd weekend and you meet friends and you come back and then you go a little bit longer and, you know, life is set up and there's a path there for it. But I mean, every time you apply for anything, you're told there's no funding, there's no money, there's no funding. Hazelwell's orthotics, you have to go through a procedure of months and months and months before you get the funding for the orthotics. It's not,
because she's warned them since birth that it's an automatic given that you have to get them when they don't fit next year.
Well, whatever you did there, Deborah, it brought you closer to the phone and we can hear you a lot better now.
Sorry.
So, yeah, no problem. You might have been on speakerphone or just away from the mouthpiece, but we can hear you loud and clear. So
okay.
You were just saying there, for anyone who didn't hear it, your daughter is 17 and she has Down syndrome. You had to apply for a range of supports and, you know, you'd look to at least have her in some form of independent living, or, you know, have some form of independence. But I'm just looking at the age. She's 17, so she's soon going to go from child disability services into adult disability services.
We're in them already, and that's another problem.
So what's that transition like?
Awful. When Hayes, they don't tell you you need to apply. It's up to you to find out of somebody else you have to apply, as in another mum. And Hazel, say, was 16 on, let's say, the 1st of January. And on the 2nd of January, she would be 16. So she's classed as a totally different person. You know, Down syndrome is completely different when you're an adult on paper with the HSE than when you're a child. So you have to apply for the medical card all over again. You have to apply for her disability allowance. You have to apply for everything. Nothing is just moved from 16 to 17.
And is she in a day service on a daily basis?
No, she's in school at the moment.
And are you working outside the home yourself then?
Oh, God, no. I don't have 5 minutes to spend for me.
So while she's out, you're organising the rest of your life. And then when she comes home, what kind of needs does she have?
She's quite good. She's quite active, little one. She's fine. She's very independent, but Hazel has a lot of she had a lot of illnesses, and we had two leg reconstructions done over the last 2 years, so we'd be a lot of physio at the moment and hospital appointments, and you know, you're trying to run from A to B and back of them, and then at the end of it you have a husband and another child.
Well, your husband's nearly take the most looking after in that respect.
Yeah, more than the two kids. I agree with you there. And the other thing is, I'm on the carer's allowance because I gave up work to look after Hazel. And I got a review in February, and you have to give your paperwork and all your documentation back within 14 days or they stop your payment. And it's means tested, which I don't agree with, because it doesn't matter how much money in the bank you have, you're still looking after your child. And I only got the paperwork today to say that it's okay, that they're still going to pay us the carer's allowance.
And in terms of the long term, you know, the arrangements that would be there for your daughter into the future, I mean, you've heard from Angelina and Anne and Joan there, who want a plan, do a bit of long term planning. In Angelina's case, she doesn't want to find herself like some of the parents in their 90s.
The same. Everybody wants to be looking out for your child.
And what response are you getting when you ask those questions as to what might be in place after your time has passed?
There's nothing there and there's no money.
And when you
that's their bottom line.
And when you hear, you know, the amount of resources that are there with rainy day funds and surplus billions and all of that that's been talked about at the moment, and what the right way to spend it is and the wrong way to spend it and what to hold back and what taxes to cut and all of those decisions that governments are balancing up, where are the decisions that you're looking for? What would you like to see done?
Well, I'd like to see that they have a database of every child that's in the country with a disability. And there's some sort of residential housing being set up, whether they buy a house in every estate that it looks after four kids and some carers in it or whatever. But I mean, there has to be money out there for something. They have to start letting the kids, you know, move away from their parents at an 18-y age, because it's not such a shock to them then at a later stage. And my child would be attached to me at my hip too. That's maybe it's just a girl thing. I don't know. But Hazel would find it extremely difficult if something happened.
So you need some level of transition and planning so that
Definitely, if God forbid
something were to happen and she was to find herself completely in an environment outside the home,
she'd
at least have some familiarity with it.
Yes, yes. That's all people are asking for. You know, the people that are in these government jobs don't get it.
And what do you make of Anne's proposal there for people to present themselves at the Dáil and show some of the challenges?
Listen,
that people are dealing with.
We've protested for the kids' hospital. We've protested for the SNAs in school. We were in the papers. We were on to Joe Duffy. Every time you look, you protest. As I said to your researcher, we cannot down tools and say, right, 2 days this week, we're not going to do anything. Because we're the ones that pick up the pieces after it. Somebody in the Dáil needs to come and spend 24 hours in our shoes and actually see what life involves.
Deirdre, you would join the protest that you heard Anne talking about earlier. Anne was floating it as an idea, as something she'd love to do. You'd join it.
Well, yes, I would. I do, as I have done in the past, I do anything possible to try and get the government, the decision makers, to sit up and take notice, because honestly, disabilities is an invisible bunch.
Well, tell us about Kate and what she needs.
Well, Kate is 19. Kate has Down syndrome. She has autism and a severe intellectual disability. She goes to day service, thank God. Even though, because of staffing issues, that sometimes has to be cut down to 4 days a week. And my day, our entire family revolve around Kate and her needs, because they are extensive. At this stage, Kate, as I said, is 19. She's an adult. She's functioning in it, about a three-year-old. She's very unpredictable. She has many challenging behaviours. So it's not everybody that can manage her. Therefore, we can't get help from, as the other ladies would have been saying, from friends, neighbours, family. In our case, it's impossible. I'm lucky I have a husband who is living here as well with us, so at least there's two of us. But it leaves very little time for family life. For example, as you mentioned earlier, socialising, holidays, all of that's off the cards.
A breather, effectively.
A breather is wonderful. Now, our breathers are when Kate goes to respite. Now, respite is wonderful, and she loves respite. However, likened to that, respite is unpredictable as well. It's not every month. It's not certain days of every month. And 2 weeks ago, I got a call from a respite house saying that Kate's respite is cancelled for the foreseeable future because the beds are taken up by people who've been left. Families are in crisis. They can't cope anymore.
Just
have to leave the family member in the hospital.
Parents or families, and this is, you know, not passing a judgment on it, but have just felt unable to take their own relative or child home from a respite house.
Absolutely on their knees. Colin, they're absolutely on their knees. The decision to do that is not an easy one. And for a family to be driven to that is cruel beyond belief. And, you know, those families need support.
I'm obviously not saying you do it. I'm not saying you do it yourself, Deirdre, but do you have some insight into what stress a family is under to bring them to the point where they just can't find it within themselves to collect their own child or relative?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, when you're going around in a circle it is a circle, it's like a vicious circle, I suppose, and what happens, I suppose, is you just lose, all your energy is sapped. You lose the energy to get up in the morning, and you get engulfed in fear as well, as the First Lady was talking about, and each person
Angelina, yeah.
Talked about the fear, Angelina, the fear of death. And if anything happens,
you share
to
that.
I'd say every carer shares that. Any carer I know has a massive fear of either getting ill or dying, and the person that they care for is left. And left then, if they're an adult and they've been living at home all their lives, then they're left in a situation where what's going to happen to them, and they're thrown into the unknown. You know, the multi-annual budget for residential care was cut in 2007, 2008, during the financial crash, and it's never been restored. Now, the government's, let's say, the Department of Health's take on it is we should try to include people with disabilities into the community and they can live there. But not all people with disabilities are able to live in the community.
Just getting back to Kate's...
They need residential.
In Kate's case, Deirdre, you said she's, you know, she... has the dual challenges of autism and Down syndrome, and kind of the behavioural levels roughly of a 3-year-old and challenging behaviour. What's the impact been on her of not being able to access the respite services?
She gets very anxious. Very, and she gets cross. She gets cross with us because she knows respite should be happening.
And when you say cross, what does that look like?
Well, cross, and her behaviours all go up a few notches in that she will, spitting is one of her big behaviours. She does that now, I have to say, anyway, but it gets worse. She'll shout, scream, cry, throw things, bang. We have her presses and all duct taped, tip things over, kick out, lash out. And I suppose besides all of that, which is difficult to manage, and especially if you're the recipient, it's seeing her distress is also heartbreaking, because it's impossible to explain to her that respite is closed. Just like, say, during COVID, we couldn't explain COVID to her. As far as Kate was concerned, I just wasn't bringing her to school. You know, and it's the same with respite. She can't understand why I'm not bringing her to respite. And going back to COVID, I mean, as another caller said, the pandemic had a huge effect on everyone, especially with people with disabilities. But we've often said we're in an endless lockdown. We hear professionals saying that during lockdown was very, very difficult for people because they had nothing to look forward to and they had no outlets. That's our lives all the time. We have nothing to look forward to.
You had a lockdown before the lockdown, during and after.
And after. Life is a lockdown. And I'm sure all your other callers would probably agree with that as well.
All right. And there are more people calling in. Just stay with us, Deirdre. We'll be back in a moment.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Cullum O'Mungain here. At the top of the programme, we heard from Angelina. She's afraid to die. She has this fear on a daily basis because she worries about what will happen to her son, Edward, who isn't able to live independently. She wants to see a care plan, some kind of a transition to a residential situation so that he'll be used to it and it won't come as a shock after her time passes, after her death, which, as I say, she is fearful of on a daily basis. Deirdre, you're in the same boat. You contacted us because you heard Angelina at the top of the programme. When you have looked for a long-term plan, what answer have you got? Have you got any indication that something is coming down the tracks in the area you're in?
No, there's nothing. We're kind of left hopeless, to be honest. We have looked since 2019, Kate applied for residential, and it's basically we get no answers. The budget is not there, or it's generally, I suppose, the budget. We really don't get anything definitive. All we want at the moment is a plan for Kate. We don't want her. We understand that somebody's not going to call us in the morning and say there's a lovely place waiting for her. But if we had a plan, that we'd have something to strive for. But there is no plan, and there's no mention of a plan. Everything is crisis managed. You know, I was reading Brendan O'Connor there a few weeks ago, and he mentioned that there was 500 billion euro wasted on PPE. 500 billion just left over.
Million, I think, but it doesn't, regardless, a lot of money.
Million, yeah. Half a billion, 500 million, yes, sorry. Yes, but half a billion is a lot of money. And yes, there's families out there begging, crying for respite.
And that 500 million people might say that 500 million, you know, whatever way it was spent because there was an identified crisis, a public health emergency, and the money had to be spent. And whatever the consequences,
and
that's what I was going to ask you. It's
yeah, absolutely. This is very much a crisis when family are pushed to leaving their family member, child or adult, and not taking them home. That's surely a crisis. And that, and the country and the Department of Health, the HSE, surely has some, I can't even think of the word, they must have some kind of a commitment or responsibility to those families.
Angelina, when you contacted us at the top, you were talking to us at the start of the programme, you said you felt forgotten, you felt isolated, you felt alone. You're certainly not alone.
I see that now. It's nice, and there were some really valid points made here. We're all just seeking a pathway for our loved ones to make sure they're safe. And I think, like, a voice at this stage, like, I know in my catchment area alone, Edward is one of 500. And just to have something solid that he can know that he has a home from home. I think listening to all these parents, that's what they want. So there's so many more out there. And it would be lovely for the HSC and Department of Health to take this on board and do this. These adults are young, vulnerable adults, children. They don't just disappear when they leave the education system or leave the system. They need to know, especially, I can speak for my son that's on the autistic spectrum. I mean, he only gets 3 respites a year, and it was 6. And he would constantly, like that other lady, would keep on, like, when's my next respite? When's my next respite? So, you know, it's just proof of what they need, you know.
And are you in touch with other parents? You know, I mean, and if there's anybody out there who knows, is there a forum? Is there an online group of parents? Are there people who share their experiences and, you know?
No, there's nobody. To come here on the show and to the radio and listen to these people has given me hope. As I said, you did ask me about my social life. Edward is my social life. I don't get time to do anything. And if I do go out for a coffee or something, you know, it's me and Edward, because I have to be there with him. He totally relies on me. So, you know, if I heard another lady there talk about going out to the doll. Yes, things like that. People really, you know, shouldn't be suffering in silence. And that's what every one of us are doing. And these people I'm hearing, I don't know whether it's people afraid to come forward or because they've been so isolated, or I suppose a word you can use is institutionalized, because all we know in our life is to look after our loved ones.
Maybe people are afraid, Angelina. Maybe they're afraid of the impact it might have on services, rightly or wrongly. Maybe they're afraid they'll be judged because of they look to be in some ways complaining about their children, which they're not. They're advocating for them. Maybe it's fear.
Yes.
Maybe it's lack of time.
It is fear. I think it is fear. And, like, to hear these people talking. It is, you know, you just want the best. And I can honestly put my hand on my heart and say that I wake up every morning thankful I'm alive, you know. And when I think of COVID, which had another big impact, I mean, those adults, children with disabilities, they regressed badly with COVID, and they continue to regress. That didn't go away. COVID is gone, or more or less gone, but the impact it had on our children, our adults, has remained, and has put them not only in fear, but the parents that are looking after them. You know, it's really, really hard. As I said to you before, dreams and wishes is just a pathway for communication, you know, and who do we rely on but our government to help us, you know? And
Margaret,
that's what I'm hoping.
Margaret, what does it look like when you do get a service?
Hello, hi. Hello, Colin.
Hiya, Margaret. Your son is 20.
Yes, yeah. And he went into care the 4th of July last year.
Full time.
Into residential. Yes, yeah. Yeah, and obviously it was very hard. I mean, the day he went, and it's easy to remember, I suppose, because it's the 4th of July, his freedom day, I guess.
Independence Day, yeah.
Independence Day, yeah. But to be honest, when he went out the door, I mean, I couldn't have felt any worse. To me, it was like the grief. Just on that day, like, you know, I couldn't have felt any worse.
Why?
You know, because I suppose I lost him in a way, and I suppose I felt I let him down. Because it was a thing that I would never... I remember saying when he was younger, over my dead body would... You know, when I was younger and he was young, that anybody would, that he would go into care, because he was, you know, he was my world, and I wanted to look after him. I wanted to mind him
and
take care of him.
I mean, he's 20.
I did. Yeah.
You took him on a long road.
Well. Yeah, yeah. I don't know where the last 5 years would have been extremely difficult from say, kind of puberty onwards, which kind of seems to happen quite early, a lot of the time, maybe, for some people that have special needs, I'm not sure. But he's getting on very well, and yeah, I mean, now I'm not needed, so it's still very difficult because...
Yeah, what, I mean, he was obviously, I mean, he still is, but he was at home, he was your life, he took up your day.
Yeah. Yes, he wasn't even in school. You know, I tried to do stuff with him at home. He wouldn't have been in school from, say, about 16 onwards. Yeah, so it was the whole time, and he didn't go to respite either. Because there was only...
What was the issue with school and respite, Margaret? How come he wasn't able to access them?
Well, respite was very scarce anyway, and then... When COVID happened, I suppose it was definitely gone. But it was only overnight respite. You couldn't really just go during the day. It had to be an overnight stay, and I guess that was kind of daunting. So that would be a huge deal, kind of, you know.
And what? Sorry, you may not want to tell us, but what's your son's name?
Mark.
Mark. And, you know, from the statements we've got from the HSE, they talk about prioritising need and all of that. So I take it from the fact that he got a place, he had fairly profound or high needs.
He did, yeah. Yeah, he did. Like, he's non-verbal. Not that that means that he doesn't know a lot. He does. But he we used to go out. I used to drive with him. He had a routine. And, you know, with autism, it's all about routine. And this drive would happen 3 times a day. Now,
how
that
far
could
are you
be
talking?
3 in the morning. A half an hour each time. We'd bring him on the motorway for a drive.
3 in the morning?
Yeah, that's used to... It could be. It's whenever Mark decided, kind of, that it was going to happen. But that was, you know, it started. And after the first one, you would know that you would get finished by maybe 3 hours later, because... You get it done over a 3 or 4 hour period. But it got to the stage where I'd go to bed because there's no point in staying up. And if he hadn't done the runs, then you just get back up. When he'd come in to me, I just get back up and, you know, dress him and shower and things. And then you go on the run.
And how
because
did you...
Because got so big and strong, you know. You had to... There wasn't any other answers, you know.
And you said puberty came on early. So, I mean, he was starting to develop effectively into a young man from, what, about age 11, 12, was it?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, that would have been it, yeah. So he was getting stronger and it just gets so much more difficult from there on, you know, from the 12 on, because they are changing and, you know, there's like, at one stage, he decided he wasn't having showers. You know, he just point blank refused. And that went on. So I just had to, like, do, you know, kind of a bed bath. So that was okay. But
and did he object to that?
No, he didn't. No, once I was doing it, kind of. I kind of knew how to get around him. And you pick your moments, you know. He could object to it 3 or 4 times, but then...
When you say object, would you be talking about physically resisting you?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no grey area. You know, if he doesn't want it, it's not happening. There was no in between, you know.
And going back to the 4th of July last, you know, when he did eventually get his place, and you said yourself there, you knew the way around him and you had an understanding with him. You could read the signs of when you could and couldn't take care of him. Was that part of the worry that maybe... You couldn't hand over all of that knowledge you had of him, all of the things you developed through your relationship with him, the love and the close proximity you had to him, that you wouldn't ever be able to hand over all that knowledge to someone who is then going to be taking over the baton from you?
Yeah, that's actually true. That's a good point. You've hit it there, yeah. Because I just knew him. I would try to explain to somebody, you know, if you have a toddler and you know their mood and you know how they are and you know if they're overtired.
Oh, I do. I know it. Every morning going out to the playgroup, yeah. I have a 3-year-old who knows her own mind.
And you're able to read them. Yeah. And that would be definitely, I was able to read Mark like a book. But as the social worker would have said to me, like, that's okay, Margaret, but if there's an emergency and, you know, you have to, you're going to hospital overnight or something and you bring in somebody, a carer, say, and Mark was obviously non-verbal. Well, then they don't know. They can't read him like I could, you know. So the social worker obviously seeing that, you know, Mark really needed to go into care. But the good news, I suppose, the good side of it is he's eating much better now. He has a more varied diet.
And what's it like going in to see him? I mean, you know, when you see other people looking after him and you see him coming on so well, does it take some of the pressure off you?
It does. It does, yes. Yeah. So Mark is in a house. It's his own home, if you like, now. He has 2 carers 24/7 doing the 12-hour shifts. So so at night time, they're up at night in case Mark needs anything. But the good thing about it was, like, when Mark left the house, I didn't feel he would ever be back. That's why I was kind of saying it's like a death. You know, he closed the door behind him. And obviously on the day, Mark wouldn't have known that he was going to his new home. And that obviously made it hard as well. Because you feel like you're kind of codding him. You know, because he didn't know. You see, the carers would have come to the home to get to know Mark a little bit as well. Plus because of COVID too, you know, it went on for quite a while. I think it was about a year that the carers were coming to the home and they'd see Mark and they used to bring him out for a drive and just for them to become familiar with him, you know. So what happened was then Mark went to his new home and eventually, say a couple of months down the line, Mark came up to visit me in my home, with his carers. And that was brilliant. I mean,
and it went well. He was able to, you know, he managed to manage the emotions of that, of leaving his new home and coming to visit you on his own terms and then going back to his residential setting without much or any difficulty? Did he manage it smoothly?
Amazingly, really. Yeah, I mean, considering, you know, how hard that must have been on him, he was amazing. And the fact that he did it so well, I mean, that was great. And that made all the difference to Mark going into care.
Well, I mean, it's obviously down to what the good work you were doing with him for over the first 20 years, that you'd given him a secure base and you'd interacted with the services in a way that they were able to come and go. And, you know, you're part of that story too.
Yeah. They kind of became like friends. Because as the other lady said there, it's very isolating. You don't see anybody. For people to be coming to the house and maybe say have a cup of tea or something, because Mark wouldn't necessarily want to come downstairs that day. That was kind of like a social thing to me, because you don't see anyone, you know. There's no you don't really have many visitors, and obviously because of COVID, there was definitely no visitors.
And how do you mind me asking, when did you start applying for this? When did the planning start? And I mean, if it's okay with you saying it, what area of the country are you in? Because it seems to contrast.
I'm in Carlow. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what area of the country the first lady was in, because I was just listening in the car on my way up to Carlow. I think we probably would have been applying for it, I would say, maybe 4 or 5 years, kind of from the 15, 16 age. Yeah. You know, especially, I suppose, because he wasn't going to school or he wasn't going to a day service. There wasn't any days. I didn't have him in a day service either. You know, when he got to 18, then say, because he wouldn't have been able to handle it. It would have been too much for that to happen, you know. So he never went to a day service. But yet he went to his new home. And to be honest, like, that day when he left, and I thought, okay, that's fine. He's going down to the house, but he doesn't know he has to stay. He doesn't literally know he's going to be kept there. I was obviously thinking that he might have self-injuring behaviours, and possibly the same at the carers. You know, I mean, I didn't sleep a wink, but it went really well, amazingly well. Yeah.
All right, we have more parents, more family members calling in. We'll get to them after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
51551 for your text. joe@rt.ie for the emails. Colm O'Mungine here. Maeve Joyce, the impact on a family of these services not being in place, what's your experience of it?
Well, my youngest son's only 9 now, so I wouldn't be looking for a residential care right now at the moment. It took a long time for the diagnosis as well, even though kind of definitely there's something wrong. But you're giving a diagnosis and you're like good luck, off you go, you know, you're missing. But my eldest daughter, 17 now, but you know, back fifth class, whatever, she used to be saying that she was going to work the job because she will always have to live with her. She will have to take over her care. So that is her aim since she's that age, because she knows she'll have to look after her if something happens to me, really, you know.
So she heard, like we heard from Angelina at the top, who's on a daily basis worried about dying and what will happen after her time. Mm-hmm. You have a daughter who, since she's 12, has been planning to step into that role after your time. She's now 17 and she has planned her life on that basis.
Yep. And someone said, recently, there to me, the siblings of children with the complex medical needs or, you know, intellectual disabilities, whatever, they become known as glass children because they're see-through.
They become known as glass children.
Glass children, because they become see-through. The focus and all your energy goes on the child that needs all your energy. We're not robots. We can only give so much. That the other child basically then becomes see-through. And it's the same, you know, when it comes to family, they always, our friends, renting, our neighbours, and they always ask about one particular child. It's like the other children just are gone, you know what I mean? So it does affect the whole family. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So glass children, just their needs are not seen. They're regarded as, you know, immediately next place in the queue because there's somebody with more obvious needs ahead of them, even though all of the emotional journeys that teenagers and all have to go on. And at age 17, your older daughter, who's planning on being a lifetime carer, has that affected her choice for what she wants to do, what her career plans are, where she live, what her hopes are, what her dreams are?
She's looking at university in Cork, and she's looking for jobs in Cork, you know, that was what she's doing, planning to buy a pharmacy. But she basically said, like, and I said to her, no, go travelling, you see the world, you know, we'll be fine. But I take on that burden. Like, she is very good socially. My older girl, she's very socially aware of a lot of things. But to have that probably in the back of her mind, that nearly worries me more in the long run, to be honest.
Right, you're worried about the kind of the emotional, or you might even call it developmental strain that it's on her, that she's kind of narrowing her horizons early.
Nearly has to step in the parenting role, you know.
And would your fear be, I mean, as an adult, you've obviously, you know, you've lived your life so far that maybe in later years, your older daughter would feel, without it being directed at her sibling or anything, that she had missed out on a chunk of life, that there was a part of her as this glass child, as you call it, that was unrealised, unseen.
I think so, I kind of see it in her sometimes, that, you know, she'd be a people pleaser, that sometimes she has panic attacks about small things, you know, general small things, but that she seems, she's a calm girl, but it could be something small that kind of sets her off. And I do think that you know, long term, I don't know. As I said, that actually nearly scares me more, to be honest. I'm lucky she's level-headed, though.
And as you say, I mean, you've encouraged her to travel. You've encouraged her to live her life. You haven't pushed her into this role. But obviously, you know, such has been the impact of her sister's intellectual disability within the family that she's picked up on it.
She is older, you know, she's 9 years older than her as well. So she, you know, she's almost like a second mommy. Sometimes we joke, like, but I don't make her care for the child. but there is that, you know, she is aware that, you know, my other daughter.
Oh, she's farsighted. I mean, it could well be the reality, couldn't it? And she's just picked up at it at 12, which is remarkable, but obviously not something that you wanted her to be contemplating, should I say, at 12.
Because even if you have a flu, now I have Crohn's disease myself, so there will be times where I wouldn't be 100%. And, you know, that probably accelerated that thought in her head as well, because I was very sick after she was born. So, that would probably play a part in it as well. That, like, you know, there's time I could barely walk. So, you know, she would take over feeding her and all that. Like, so, you know, all those bits,
Amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've heard, you know, stories every year at the Carers Awards and that young people who step up like that, they're amazing people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, anyway, you must be...
It's not talked about siblings, and I mean... As parents, it's not even talked about, like, for parents. We are invisible. We do this every day. It's 24 hours. It doesn't end on a Friday. It's Christmas. It's summer. It's weekends. And the services, I mean, even pre-COVID, you'd get an email about a webinar every kind of month, whatever. Sounds, that's great, you know, brilliant.
All right.
But that was it. You know, and then when you are looking for something, it's a fight. And you know what? We're all tired from the fight. And it's a fight, and it's like we are meant to know all these things or something, and you know, we didn't learn that. I didn't do this really thing first. But it's like, oh, did you not know that? No, I did not know that. And it's only by other people, and it's always only by other people, and it's other people who've fought the battle before us, and we'll continue to fight the battle. But it shouldn't have to be a battle. Every day is a battle. I'll be perfectly honest. If you get out of bed in the morning, it's a battle.
Maeve, look, thanks a million for talking to us. We have more to get to after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungine here. Lots of parents, family members contacting us on 51551 by text, joe@rt.ie by email, of course, on the phone 0818 715 815 and on the WhatsApp 087 184 3709. Angelina, we began with you and you were telling us about Edward and the services, or at least the clarity about residential services that you don't have and that you very much need. I mean, is there anything you heard from, would say, you know, Deirdre, who was talking about her son as well, and the benefits that care have given and what that allowed him to do and the freedom it's given him? I mean, does at least that give you some idea of what's available? Does that make it more frustrating or give you some cause for hope that there might be something available, but even if you don't have the clarity now about it?
Well, as I said, it's the fear of the unknown. And that lady, Deirdre from Carlow, it was lovely that I know her son got, she applied for it 5 years ago and didn't have the resources that I have. But it is clear from all the people speaking how important the pathway, you know, for a residential, or the pathway is made available.
Yeah,
and
indeed,
it's really comes down to better communication, you know, and the funding for disability supports that is meaningful. I keep saying this, like, not to be left without knowing our closed doors.
That's what you need. The clarity, Angelina. I'm sorry to cut across you, but we're up against the clock there, and that's all we have time for today. It's been a privilege talking to you and everybody else. Ruth Kennington was on sound today. The broadcast coordinator was Stephen Higgins. Sian O'Gorman produced, and the series producer is Annette Egan. I'm Colm O'Mungine. Stay tuned. Tune for Ray Darcy next.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.